for up to $10,000.
The remains stay on the lunar surface, they soft land, and they're there as a permanent memorial, so someone can go out at night and see a full moon and see mom or granddad or their best friend.
I'm Dave Anthony, Fox News Radio.
You're listening to 1460 WVOX, the official station of New Rock City, the place where you can enjoy a wholesome family entertainment experience.
Updated weather forecast for Westchester County and vicinity, we have a stationary front to our south. The front lies from northern sections of Oklahoma, then through southern Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and into Maryland. The frontal system is going to be a pathway for areas of low pressure over the nation's midsection to arrive in the east. And when they do get to the east, they're probably going to pick up some moisture and some cold air aloft, too. That's going to give us mixed precipitation in the form of some snow and sleet. Could cause a little slushy accumulation at some point during the daytime on Friday or Friday evening. Then we get into a clearing trend to breezy and cooler weather for this upcoming weekend. So for today, it looks like cloudy weather with the possibility of some occasional rain and showers, or highs in the mid-40s. Tonight, periods of rain for the evening, rain and wet snow overnight, nighttime low temperatures in the middle 30s. Rain, sleet, and snow during the daytime on Friday. It'll be a chilly day with our highs only in the 30s to near 40. In some spots, there could be a little slushy accumulation of a coating to less than an inch. At night, still the possibility of some rain, sleet, and snow. That'll be Friday night, ending overnight. Nighttime lows in the upper 20s could cause some icy spots towards daybreak. Then on Saturday, mostly sunny, a breezy but cool day in the lower 40s. Sunday features sunshine, upper 40s. And Monday, mostly cloudy with a chance of some rain and snow in the afternoon and at night, highs in the mid-40s. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for WVOX and WVIP, the Whitney Radio Network.
The latest forecast from the 1460 WVOX Weather Center, brought to you by Entergy and the Indian Point Energy Center, right for New York.
At Entergy, meeting our region's need for reliable, affordable, and clean electricity is an everyday success story. That's because our Indian Point Energy Center supplies up to 38% of the region's power needs. It also produces some of the least expensive power generated in the region. And most importantly, it does not produce greenhouse gas emissions. That's right, zero greenhouse gases. This plays a key role in helping this area improve its air quality. So it should come as no surprise that a growing number of environmentalists, including Dr. Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, say nuclear power is a vital tool in the fight against global warming. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.safesecurevital.com. Because the more you know, the more you realize that Indian Point's clean, reliable, and affordable energy is a big part of the climate change solution.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
Good morning and welcome to Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Levensold, your host for this series on the natural world, education, and culture. We bring you guests from diverse disciplines, scientists, activists, authors, educators, entertainers, and public officials. We seek to stimulate your curiosity, intellect, and passion. Today's news from the natural world. Today is Thursday, March 27th, 2008, the eighth day of glorious spring. We have gained 3 minutes of daylight since yesterday, 39 minutes since last we met 2 weeks ago. 39 minutes of daylight in just 2 weeks. And it goes on and on and on until the summer solstice in around June 20th, 21st. Haven't looked it up. The sun rose at 6:46 daylight savings time this morning. It will set at 7:15 this evening. We will have 12 hours and 29 minutes of daylight today. The moon set this morning at 9:24, which is perhaps a half hour ago, and it will rise again at 1:33 tomorrow morning. 2 days until last quarter, the moon next becomes full on April 20th. Our tides, the next high tide in New Rochelle, 3:26. In Yonkers, 207, Dobbs Ferry, 235, and in Peekskill, the next high tide is at 3:30 p.m. Our regular feature now, names of American service members who have lost their lives in Iraq. May they live on in all of our hearts. 23 troops died just this month. That's only up to March 22nd, which is 5 days ago, so perhaps the toll is even higher. American deaths in Iraq have now passed the 4,000 mark. Those who were killed on March 22nd are Thomas C. Ray II, age 40, of the North Carolina National Guard. He was from Weaverville, North Carolina. David S. Stelmatt, 27, also from the North Carolina National Guard, but his hometown actually was Littleton, New Hampshire. So David moved from New Hampshire down to North Carolina, and at age 27, he met his end in Iraq. David B. Williams, age 26, also from that same unit, the North Carolina National Guard. He was from Tarboro, North Carolina. The three of these gentlemen were killed, or three of these soldiers, were killed when their vehicle encountered a roadside bomb in Iraq on March 22nd. On March 21st, Tyler J. Smith of Bethel, Maine. He was age 22. He died from incoming fire on his base. Gregory D. Unruh, age 28, from Dickinson, Texas, died on March 19th. Michael D. Elledge, age 41, of Brownsburg, Indiana, and Christopher C. Simpson of Hampton, Virginia, were both killed on March 17th by a roadside bomb during combat operations. Each life is a treasure and a tragic loss. Close to 30,000 American servicemen and women have been wounded in the current conflict, and there is no count available for Iraqi soldiers or civilians. And I don't think it's heresy for me to feel and to state that Iraqi lives are lives. Many of them are civilians. I don't mind terrorists being killed because they're trying to kill us, but innocent bystanders, innocent what they call collateral damage. I don't know how you reduce killing a person to collateral damage, but they're people too, and they deserve the same respect as other innocents. May these American servicemen live forever in our hearts, and may this feature come to an end in the very near future, because there are no more deaths to report. Okay, now for the Culture Corner, my reviews of plays, ballets, opera, museums, and what have you. Keep in mind that these are my opinions, and you have the right to differ from them, for everyone has the right to be wrong. Okay, first of all, The Homecoming, a Broadway play. Harold Pinter is not for everyone. He can be surreal. His sense of humor can be missed. His moral lessons of the dark vision of human life can be disturbing. But most important when dealing with Pinter is that the director and the actors get him. They got to understand this play, and you got to stay with a rather complex mind there. Otherwise, you have no chance at a successful production. Fortunately, this production is spot on. Daniel Sullivan's production is like a single clear note on a well-tuned, precious antique violin. A veteran director with 16 Broadway plays to his credit, he also directed the fabulous Mary Louise Parker play, Proof. In fact, not only is it like a single clear note on a well-tuned, precious antique violin, it's like creating a website on the Apple Pro... Pro Blackbook Pro, I forgot what we call my computer, but I love it, and I have some great people helping me to put my website together. I would acknowledge them further, but I could get someone in trouble. The Sterling cast, now we're talking about The Homecoming. that was quite a break from The Homecoming. The Sterling cast here shares the credit. Ian McShane's Broadway debut was 40 years ago at the same time as this play, The Homecoming, started up. He plays Max. If you're an HBO fan, you will remember him as Al Swearingen, the saloon owner and behind-scenes controller who was not above murder as a business tool. That was the Deadwood series. He was good there, and he's good here. Also, Raul Esparza, Michael McKean, James Frayne, and Gareth Sachs do very well. But when Eve Best first made her appearance, she's the only woman in this play as Ruth, I was, oh, okay, ho-hum, here's an actress, not so glamorous, not a hot young thing, she's in her 30s, blah, 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 not that that's old. She's not so glamorous, a role that's not going anywhere interesting, it seemed kind of boring, but by the time she got through bringing Ruth to life, I wanted to climb the stage and take a big bite right out of her, so captivating was she. Eve Best can keep a room full of men on a string, like a spider keeps flies on the strands of her web, mesmerized, rapt, entranced into silence. I cannot imagine an actress underplaying sexiness so effectively and absolutely touching me in places of which I dare not elaborate on air. All right, that was The Homecoming. And we also saw Falstaff at the New York City Opera. Thank goodness for operas like Giuseppe Verdi's Falstaff. Nobody dies. No love goes unrequited. Just a big, fat, tubby Falstaff. He just merely must suffer the humiliation he most richly deserves, but even so, he recovers nicely. The ingenue and her lover are married, despite her father's wishes that she marry someone else. In most opera, these things would become tragedy, but not so with Falstaff. He's proud of his big belly, refers to it lovingly and often, and even claims it saved his life when he was thrown into the river with the dirty laundry by helping him to float. "We are all fools," the singers say, as they point to us, the audience, at the end. Singing is okay, the sets are simple, the music is fine, but the story behind the opera itself is more interesting. Verdi was a rich, old, and retired man at 75 years old, but he still had one more opus in him. He thought about it, and finally he found the project that would float his boat, an opera based on Shakespeare's Merry Wives of Windsor and Henry IV and V, and the character of Falstaff. So he and his librettist, they kept very mum about this one last opera for almost 2 years, but finally announced it publicly. He was over 75 years of age, and mind you, this was more back in the late 1800s, so the age 75 was even older than today. We think of it as, oh, well, and not so old, but back then it was. Verdi, he used his wealth philanthropically. He endowed a home for destitute musicians in Milan, which still operates today, 115 years later. He put in a hospital for the poor in his home village. New York City Opera does much with their resources. The house is great. The seats roomy and comfortable. Nothing outstanding about this production, but it was a nice night out. And just a couple of words about Ibsen's Ghosts, which I saw at the Pearl Theater Company last weekend. This is on St. Mark's Place, and I'd like to say more about the Pearl Theater, really, and the theater company. They do a really good job with their off-Broadway resources. They have a vision, and artistic director Shepard Sobel speaks of classical theater as art that goes deeper than lessons in specific circumstances. He speaks of providing a rudder for the audience to navigate our species' journey in history, quite lofty. He wants to change the world. Okay, not so bad. And of course, to some extent, all serious theater aspires to that. And even airheaded musicals, by bringing joy, however momentary, make the world a better place. Ghosts as drama reminds us that all of our personal histories are full of specters. Wherever we go, we are haunted, and part of our calling as humans is to come to peace with them, to go on in spite of the bad ones while holding hands with the good ones. I think we are the only animals with that ability, be it curse or blessing. Do chimpanzees and bonobos feel the weight of their pasts or just the very real pains of their bodies? We can never know. Hang on just a little second here. Okay, let's identify ourselves before we introduce our guest. This is Environmentally Sound on WVOX AM 1460, coming out of New Rochelle, New York. If you're listening in Bombay or Calcutta, India, Glens Falls or Schenectady, New York, Savannah, Georgia, or the savannas of Africa, or on Charming Springs Farm in Womelsdorf, Pennsylvania, you have logged on to www.wvox.com. And you are listening live. Okay, my first guest today is Seth Bengelsdorf, a one-to-one tutor. Okay, I can't mention where he is. He's a computer expert, but we're going to have to talk to him about his other passion for reasons that we won't take the airtime to explain. Anyway, this is Seth Bengelsdorf speaking to us from the Westchester in Westchester County. Welcome, Seth Bengelsdorf.
Good morning, Robert. Thanks for having me on.
How you doing, Seth? It's great to have you on. And I'll skip right to the last question because the first four have been knocked off. Yeah, you are the president of the of a Saab group. Saab, S-A-A-B, the cars.
No, actually, I'm not. I'm not the editor president. And publisher of Nines, which is the Saab magazine of the Saab Club of North America.
Now, tell me what's so special about Saabs.
Well, first of all, in keeping with the reason why you're on the air today, the environmental impact of cars obviously is fairly massive in this world. Saab has done and is continuing to do a number of things to try and lessen that. They've had a huge inner workings with the Swedish government. They have an E85 engine that's called the Biopower.
E85? What does that mean?
Which means that it can work off of renewable resources. So, you know, E85 is 15% gasoline and 85% of an ethanol type of gas that comes from crops, comes from corn, comes from things like that. It's huge in Sweden. They sell more cars there with that engine than any other manufacturer. They're going to be bringing that engine here to this country, we hope, within the next 18 months. It's an amazing engine. It actually gets more power per piece of energy than standard gasoline, and obviously impacts the environment much, much less. They're also working on electric engines. They have a concept car, a convertible, with a small electric engine in each wheel that provides power.
They don't seem to do much promotion in this country. Why don't we hear more about Saab?
Well, there's a good reason for that. They're a very, very small manufacturer. In this country, the amount of cars that they sell per year is probably the amount of cars Chevy sells in a week. So the marketing budget isn't very large. The amount of cars they sell isn't very large. And yet the technology that they bring to the table and the environmental, sort of safety and the environmental just outlook
and
that they have.
They probably sell out without even having to advertise anyway, right? People
They do know. And they don't. I mean, the automotive business is an extraordinarily difficult business. This environmental climate. So there's cars out there. They don't have the environmental engine, the E85 engine that we were talking about in this country yet because of certification issues, but it's coming. And the way, the entire world is turning now and looking for, environmental changes and
absolutely
global changes. Well, I mean, it's coming. It's coming from a lot of manufacturers. But
now, you didn't say anything about, you said they have electric cars and they have this the cars that run on 85% biofuel, but you haven't said anything about a hybrid. Those are not hybrids. They're either all electric or all gasoline, right?
Well,
and they're
right
not diesel either, are they?
The electric engine is just a concept. They're calling it a biofuel because it's not really a hybrid. A hybrid is two systems working like an electric boost too. And what this is going to be, what's coming in the near term, is not going to be a hybrid. It's going to be a very, very highly advanced vehicle that uses mostly renewable resources. Part of the reason why it's not here yet is Saab's two biggest markets are New York and California. And in both of those markets, there's actually one station that has the E85 fuel available. So the infrastructure isn't quite available. This country isn't working nearly as hard as, for example, Sweden, which has huge amounts of the availability of this, resource, this fuel, so that Saab can sell huge amounts of cars and, in fact, impact the environment much, much less than a standard gasoline-burning vehicle would. I do want to put in a plug, if I may, for the club, which is SaabClub.com.
Uh-huh.
People, if your viewers, your listeners can go to that location, they can read about the club, they can read about the magazine. We have our annual convention that's coming up in August, the end of August, up in the Boston area, so there's going to be a lot of Saab people. This is Saab's first, when they first came to the country, the Northeast is where they first came in, and it's known and still known as a winter car. So it's going to be a big deal. We figure, 500 to 1,000 people.
Wow.
And their cars.
What is that website again?
The website is SaabClub.com.
Yes. SaabClub.com. Okay.
And on the left side, there's a navigation bar, and you can learn about the club. You can learn about the convention. You can learn about signing up for being a member of the club. It's a really neat deal.
And of course, what nobody can tell because of this line of questioning, but I can say what I want to say, and I would like to say that Seth is also quite a computer expert. He's also a tutor, and I met him that way. He can't say it because of corporate rules, but he's quite a computer expert. We were going to talk about that, but we could not. So this is a well-rounded individual that you have just listened to, and I thank you very much for coming on, Seth.
Thank you for having me, Robert. You have a great day.
I'll see you very soon.
Okay.
Okay. Just one item of business before we bring on our next guest. This is just a word about the Learning Shop of Harrison, New York. The Learning Shop is a full-service tutoring company year-round, but when it comes to the summertime, which is not that far off, they have a music program that will take your talented child, grandchild, or yourself on a journey with talented working musicians, including singers, engineers, and songwriters. They teach about songwriting, playing and writing as members of a band. It's different from sitting at home and just playing and playing as a member of a group. And more rewarding in some ways, too, because you get so much richer music that way. For those most interested in the technical part of the music and the recording industry, hands-on experience with Pro Tools, which is the industry standard for professional recording in studios across the globe. This is an education that will take your music-interested novice into a world of professional musicianship, singing, and recording. And I know these instructors personally. I've learned theory from Helena Lind, recorded with Michael Messier as my engineer, and listened to the fine vocals and songwriting of Rebecca Haviland. These instructors are all very talented, patient, and fine instructors. And a little plug for Paul Blank, who is also an increasingly great musician. Every time I hear him play the piano and compose things, he just gets better. The Learning Shop is located in Harrison. Their telephone number is 914-835-1070. Again, they're located in Harrison. And if you did not have a chance to write that down, just call us here at WVOX and ask for the number. They will address all your tutoring needs. I just stress the music at this time because summer is upcoming. Again, telephone number of the Learning Shop in Harrison is 914-835-1070. You're listening to WVOX. And if you are listening in Lisbon, Portugal, Gdańsk, Poland, Seville, Spain, Comune Nuovo, Italy, or Bayonne, New Jersey, you have logged on to www.wvox.com and you are listening live. My next guest is Carl Zimmer. He's the author of 6 books. The 7th is due out in May. He also writes for National Geographic, Scientific American, Discover, and the New York Times, and I'm sure other publications as well. In 2007, he won the National Academy's Communication Award, which, just to put it in perspective, it's the equivalent of an Oscar if he were a screenwriter. It's the highest honor that a science writer can get. Welcome, Carl Zimmer.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's my great pleasure. You're speaking to us from Connecticut, yes?
That's right.
Well, I have in my hand this book, Parasite Rex, which has kept me absolutely enraptured for the last few years. I read it first. I read part of it back when it came out in 2000, and I put it down because when you read a book that makes a point and then gets very anecdotal, as this does, you read part of it and you kind of get it. But when I came back to it, I just had to read all of it because each of the anecdotes, each of the life histories, if you will, of each of these parasites is just very interesting. And for those of you who are listening who don't know what a parasite is, just cut open your belly and look inside because you have parasites, as do we all. Carl, tell us, just basically so that a lay audience can understand, what is a parasite?
Well, there are a lot of different definitions of a parasite. I mean, the one I find that works best is basically some organism that lives on or in another organism at its expense. So when the parasite benefits, the host suffers. Historically, the term parasite has been used for parasitic animals. So you're talking about things like a tapeworm or a liver fluke or something like that. But really, I think that the parasite applies to bacteria and viruses that live parasitically. And what's really striking is that whether they're viruses or bacteria or animals or fungi or plants, they all tend to use a lot of the same strategies to exploit their hosts, to manipulate their hosts, and to have more success themselves.
Now, you did say they live, and this is the traditional definition that I've always understood, that a parasite is something that lives off a host, that it benefits and the host actually suffers, as opposed to a symbiotic relationship where both gain something from it. But as I read the book, there are many anecdotes in there which suggest that the actions of these parasites actually helps, if not the individual, the species to evolve. What do you have to say about that?
Well, certainly parasites have big effects on their hosts. And on their host's evolution. So, you know, if there's a virus that is killing a lot of members of a species, if there are any of those hosts that have mutations that are going to make them more resistant to that virus, then they're going to be the ones who survive and pass on their genes. And then as new mutations arise, those are going to be favored as well. And so in a sense, that virus is shaping its host's DNA, but the thing is that the virus is evolving too at the same time. So the host has to evolve even more. That's just what happens. And so scientists call this an arms race. And so we humans are. If you look at our genome, a lot of it has been shaped by this kind of an arms race.
And according to Lynn Margulis, who has been on this program several times, the fact that we have bits of genomes from other animals has actually enhanced our species, has advanced us to where we would not be as intelligent, for instance, as we are today without. It's not just an arms race. It's not just, okay, we're going to trump you, you're going to trump us, not cops and robbers. We're going to put fences up, gates on the windows, and okay, well, we'll just clip the lock. Carl, we're going to have to come back. We have to take a quick break, but hang on, and we'll bring you back in right after the break, okay? Okay, you are listening to AM 1460 WVOX in New Rochelle, New York. This is Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Levensold. We're speaking with Carl Zimmer, and we will be right back with Carl in just a moment.
The flagship station of Whitney Media, 1460 WVOX and worldwide at WVOX.com. Now, the latest update from Fox News Radio.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lori London.
State progress.
In the past year, we have seen significant security gains
result from the surge.
President Bush is speaking in Dayton, Ohio at this hour, says he endorses a plan for a pause in troop pullbacks following the removal of surge forces this summer. And a speech by a presidential wannabe.
Under Republican and Democratic administrations, we failed to guard against practices that all too often rewarded financial manipulation instead of productivity and sound business practices.
Senator Barack Obama in Manhattan speaking on the economy.
As most experts agree, our economy is in a recession.
Calling for modernizing the country's regulation of financial markets, Obama was introduced by New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who so far hasn't endorsed anyone but says it's good to hear the candidates' positions. Fox News, we report, you decide.
Family. Isn't that what it's all about? Being together, having fun, laughing, enjoying? Where can you go in Westchester with your entire family and encompass all those things? Well, there's one place, and if you haven't already guessed, it's New Rock City in New Rochelle. Everything is made to order for you and your family to enjoy. Whether it's 18 movie theaters or a 17-lane bowling alley, miniature golf, pool and billiards, video arcades, family restaurants, kids' parties to delight all ages, New Rock City has it all for you and yours. Family fun is back in style again, and New Rock City is simply the best thing to happen for families in Westchester County. They've made it their business to make your comfort level exactly that, comfortable by being together and having a fun time. New Rock City, a place you'll want to go back to time and time again, right in the heart of New Rochelle. Just take I-95 to exit 16 or take the Hutchinson River Parkway. New Rock City, where family fun is waiting for you.
Welcome to Bob's Sports Zone. You here to watch the big game?
No, we're here to play the big game.
Play it? Aren't you guys a tad scrawny?
Hey, come on. Hey.
What, do you have to be built like a linebacker to play quick draw?
Nope, come on in.
Come on, eight!
Come on, eight! Did eight make a touchdown?
No, we're playing quick draw over here.
I want to play quick draw.
Oh, me too. I wish I knew how.
Oh, it's simple. Just pick up to 10 numbers and then decide how much you want to play for.
Wow, that sounds exciting.
Trust me, it is. And then watch 20 numbers pop up on the TV and see if your numbers match.
That's it?
Not quite. You could win up to 100 grand for just a buck.
Oh, man, look, the game's over.
Oh, don't worry. There's a new game every 4 minutes.
Play quick draw, the fast-paced, exciting numbers game from the New York Lottery at a sports pub, bowling alley, diner, or anywhere else the game is played. Hey, you never know.
Hey, darts anyone?
Forget darts.
Ow! What was that?
2 minute warning for another game of quick draw.
To learn how you can be part of the fun, go to nylottery.org and use the quick draw locator tool to find the location closest to you.
A lot of people sell office equipment, copy and fax machines. Some of the technology they're peddling is superb, and some of it is not so stellar, I'm afraid. Thus, the dealer you buy from is just as important, you know, as the brand you select. Since 1972, the most respected, reliable dealer has been Vista Business Products. George and Bob Forstbauer's Vista, number one authorized Canon dealer in the tri-state area. They're the oldest and most established. So for the very best up-to-the-minute technology in copying, document management, rely on Vista, the newest technology from the oldest dealer. Westchester headquarters in Elmsford off 287 and 119. Call George or Bob Forstbauer, their sons George Jr., Bob Jr. There's even a daughter, Christine, in the family business. Vista Business Products and Canon.
Call 914-347-7888 or visit us on the web at www.vistacanon.com.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
Okay, we are back. You're listening to Environmentally Sound on AM 1460, WVOX in New Rochelle, or you're listening on www.wvox.com. We are speaking with Carl Zimmer, science writer par excellence. Still with us, Carl?
Yep.
Good. We were talking just before the break about how evolution is actually served. It's not just an arms race, as you call it. Evolution is actually advanced, and to the extent that we can place any kind of value judgments on this, the human race has gotten stronger, brighter, more resourceful, not just ahead of the parasites. What do you say about that?
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, there have been cases where parasites have kind of been domesticated and actually sort of incorporated into us. So, for example, our ability just to use oxygen to generate energy, we do that with little sausage-shaped structures in our cells called mitochondria. Those mitochondria were once upon a time bacteria. We know that because they still have little bits of DNA inside of them that look a lot like the bacteria of particular kinds of bacteria. They don't look like the rest of our DNA. So these bacteria probably invaded the cells of our distant ancestors billions of years ago. Maybe lived at first as parasites, but eventually sort of got into a different kind of a relationship where they were providing some services to the host, and the host was giving them shelter and so on. So, you know, parasites can certainly, you know, their role can certainly change over time through evolution, and, you know, those can be beneficial. So, you know, the fact that we can live on land and breathe air and so on, ultimately we have our parasites to thank for that.
Right, and they also enable speciation, according to Lynn Margulis's work, Acquiring Genomes. And it is, in fact, that's the main engine of evolution, according to Lynn. And I give her a lot of credence, even though it's almost impossible to prove that without being very lucky in catching it as it's happening, the way she explains it. Not that I understand everything she explains to me. But species are actually created through the acquisition of genomes more than just random mutations. Do you agree with that?
Well, in some cases, that's, you know, there's a lot of evidence to support that. I'm not sure that that's a statement that you could just make across the board. But certainly it's true that, you know, viruses are constantly infecting bacteria and other microbes, and they're bringing genes with them. And in a sense, they can, in a sense, kind of create a new species sometimes. And you know, that's actually, you know, a problem for us because they can become, you know, resistant to antibiotics because these viruses are actually carrying genes that are giving resistance to these drugs. So it's not just important in terms of basic natural history. It's also important in terms of medicine.
Well, in fact, then they are driving our culture by forcing us to create medicines, other treatments to counter that, and as we do that, we're stretching our own brains and our own scientific abilities. Am I stretching the point too much, or can you accept that?
Well,
Well, you know, there certainly has been a lot of intellectual effort put into trying to fight off diseases. Unfortunately, the irony is that sometimes our cures bring problems of their own.
So,
sure. You know, antibiotics were a magnificent discovery and have really helped cut down a lot of infectious diseases. But the problem is that we use them too much. You know, people will demand antibiotics for a viral infection.
Which they do no good for.
It does no good at all. And all that happens is that it creates the conditions that favor the evolution of more and more resistant bacteria. So now we have bacteria that are resistant to just about every antibiotic ever invented.
Well, the only excuse I've ever heard a doctor give, which I don't accept, but which at least I can process it logically, is that if you're already infected with a virus, you want to make sure you don't get a bacterial infection on top of it, which could be much worse. Rather, they say, well, we're not really treating the virus. But I think what they're doing is they're just trying to calm their patients. They are, well, you know what? Here, take this antibiotic. It's almost like a placebo for them.
Well, I think a lot of patients actually demand antibiotics.
But a doctor shouldn't give in to that, right?
Excuse me?
Doctors shouldn't give in to that.
They shouldn't, but sometimes they do.
But they do. Okay. What brings to mind a little analogy here, in war, and let's take the two wars, the actual wars that we think of as war, and the war between parasites and their hosts, in creating ways to fight wars better, many wonderful electronics and other inventions have come forth, which become very useful to the civilian population. So, is that an analogy, or am I just blowing hot air?
As I said before, there are certainly cases where, the coevolution of hosts and parasites have led to a lot of new adaptations, and sometimes the parasites themselves have actually been kind of domesticated to our own benefit. I mean, another example I'll give is virus. There are certain kinds of viruses that they don't just infect cells; they actually insert their own DNA into their host genome, and like our own genomes. This can happen to humans and other animals, and sometimes their DNA ends up getting passed down from generation to generation. It becomes a sort of a permanent part of that host genome. And initially, it's just virus DNA, but it may mutate like anything else in a genome over time. Turns out that some of this virus DNA got mutated and became part of a gene that is important for the development of the placenta. So the placenta is essential for the development of mammals like us. And part of that equipment for building placentas actually came from the viruses that infected us. So there's one example where, you do have this new kind of equipment that is built in part from the DNA of our parasites.
What kind of equipment?
The genes that will will control a whole set of other genes that are involved in building a placenta at the appropriate time.
Okay, now here's something that you talk about in your book. Parasites may have caused the evolution of sex. Now, sex is not the most efficient way of reproduction by far, and yet we have it. Can you explain that?
Sure. So If you're just a bacterium, one way that you can reproduce is simply to split in two, and then you become two identical clones, and then those two can split, and then you have four and eight and 16 and so on. Some animals can do that too. So there are certain lizards, for example, where they're all female, and the eggs of the female just start developing into more female lizards, and there's no need for males. If you compare those lizards to ordinary lizards, or us, or other animals that reproduce sexually with a male and a female, I mean, our rate of growth is a lot slower because every time a female is going to reproduce, there has to be a male. So you have to have half males and half females in the population And so that's just going to slow you down.
And you don't have to take yourself to a movie and buy yourself a drink either.
That's right. The whole courtship ritual.
You can just go home and just do it.
Wake up in the morning, there's two of you, whatever.
So how did Parasites accomplish this?
Well, some scientists have argued that the advantage of sex, which maintains it, even though there's this other advantage of not having sex, the advantage of sex is that it provides a better defense against parasites. In other words, if a parasite can basically adapt to infecting a host, deal with that host's genome, well, if that host then just clones itself, if it splits in two, then there are two identical copies of that host, and the parasite will be able to infect them just as easily. And so it'll just be able to attack all of these clones and kill a lot of them. Now, if you've got some organism that's having sex, well, what happens in sex is that actually genes are getting mixed together in different combinations. That's why, unless you're identical twins, you and your siblings are not identical to each other, because you're lots of different combinations of your parents' DNA. And in some of those combinations, so a particular parasite might do a good job of attacking one person, the result of sexual reproduction, but the next person over is going to be this new combination of genes. And so the parasite might not do as good a job of infecting that person. So that may give sexual reproducing organisms kind of the leg up.
Now, you say in only 50 generations, a single cloning lizard could swamp the descendants of a million sexual ones. And I presume 50 generations, I presume their generations are a matter of months, if not days.
Yeah,
right?
it's just sort of like compound interest. They're just, they're growing. If every organism in a generation can reproduce, then you're going to have this explosive growth. But clearly, when it comes to animals and plants and fungi, for lots and lots and lots of big groups of species, sex rules. So the question is why. There's a lot of evidence suggesting that it's parasites that are responsible.
And sexually reproducing organisms are, we see them at least as being the highest functioning of animals. Certainly, we think of ourselves as being the most intelligent and creative and resourceful and adaptive creatures on Earth, and we couldn't exist asexually, right?
Who knows? If cloning really takes off, maybe we will start existing asexually.
Thought.
I'm not sure that we have sex to credit with our with our lofty accomplishments.
Wow.
But certainly, at the very least, we probably wouldn't have lasted very long if our ancestors hadn't evolved sex.
So, in the absence of parasites, we might have evolved just as intelligently without any sex. That's a logical conclusion, isn't it?
Well, hard to say.
Okay, look, you describe parasites as you said, as organisms or viruses, which are not organisms, which live on or in other organisms and contribute nothing to them. You say that they take many forms, from barnacles to flukes, the flukes you're talking about, and other worms, flukes being a worm, and protozoa. In fact, from four kingdoms of the five, and I'm guessing it was plants which are excluded. Am I right? I mean, the five kingdoms are animals, bacteria, protoctis, I guess, and fungi, and plants.
Mm-hmm.
So is plants the one that's excluded from that? Parasites?
Excluded in terms of, there are parasitic plants. No, there are parasites across
all
life.
Kingdoms.
And,
okay.
I mean, and parasites are the most successful kind of life. I mean, every organism can be infected with at least one parasite. And in our case, like us, dozens or hundreds of species can infect us. Mm-hmm. So just by simple math, the parasites are way ahead of us hosts.
Okay. Now they're fascinating. First of all, you call the cuckoo bird, and I added to that the brown-headed cowbird, as parasites because they lay their eggs in the nests of other birds, which then have to raise their young, and they probably throw the eggs of the other birds out, if I remember my birding very well. So a bird can be a parasite, according to that definition, right?
Right. I mean, these birds are sometimes called social parasites
social
because they're
parasites.
Not actually like crawling inside another bird, but they are manipulating birds in a lot of the same ways that a tapeworm might manipulate its host. It uses all sorts of kinds of deception and so on. I mean, it's quite amazing when you look at a picture of one of these cuckoos in a host bird's nest. I mean, they're big and they're bigger than their mother, and they're sitting there. And yet this mother bird is still going out and feeding it worms. And you wonder, well, how is it that this mother bird is being fooled by this parasite?
Well,
and what they do is these cuckoos can actually sing so that in such a way that it sounds like a whole nest full of the chicks of the mother. So it's doing this weird ventriloquism that is just... throws off the mother, and the mother bird just doesn't know to abandon the nest. It's being manipulated, and parasites, more conventional kinds of parasites manipulate the behavior of their hosts as well.
Well, does the cuckoo lay its eggs in a specific bird's nest, or do these nestlings actually learn to sing?
They're particular species.
It's particular species. So their natural sounds attract them up. Yeah, the picture's in your book. It's really, you're right. It looks like this baby could devour its mother. Some very interesting things I'd like you to talk about. There are ant parasites, these minims with the leafcutter ants, and the anal shotgun for fecal discharge to escape the parasitic wasps, and just one lead, and also the owls, which use snakes to clean nests of parasites. Could you address those three? The owls using snakes, the anal shotgun for caterpillars, and the minims, the leafcutter ants, which ride shotgun. Can you talk about those? They're fascinating.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, basically, these are all examples of hosts that have evolved ways to very clever ways of dealing with their parasites, birds will have various ways of keeping their nests clean, for example, and they'll have other animals in there to take care of the parasites because mites can be a real they can kill fledglings, and so adaptations that let the birds fight off those parasites are going to mean that their baby survives. The weirdest adaptation that I ever came across was this way that certain caterpillars will basically turn themselves into cannon to get rid of their droppings. What they do is they'll be eating their food, and then it's time for them to relieve themselves, and they have this strange little set of blood vessels and muscles at their back end, and what they can do is they basically fire their droppings several feet away from where they're eating. And so, you wonder, like, why on earth would this caterpillar make itself into a cannon? Well, the reason is that there are these wasps, parasitic wasps. There are hundreds of thousands of species of parasitic wasps, and you may sometimes see them in your garden when they've infected a caterpillar, and the baby wasps are coming out and making their cocoons on top of it. So a caterpillar does not want to be attacked by these parasitic wasps. And these wasps will often use smells from the caterpillar to find them. And some of the best smells come from their droppings. And so the wasp will home in on the droppings. So basically what these caterpillars are doing is they're just trying to get this stuff away as far as possible so that the wasps won't find them.
So the wasp comes down attracted by the aroma of the caterpillar droppings and finds nothing but the droppings, and the caterpillar lives another day or another hour or whatever.
Right.
Fascinating. Now, what about these ants? You talk about the leafcutter ants. Now, just briefly, leafcutter ants, I'm sure most people have seen pictures of them. They go through the forest, the jungle, and they take bits of leaves and they cut them off and they carry them back to their nests, and they don't eat the food. What they do, they don't eat the leaves. What they do is they cultivate a certain fungus in their nest. And there are the tiny little ants, the minims, with same species but just a different, I don't know what they are, and they tend that. But sometimes they go riding with these ants to protect them from parasites. Now, how does that work?
Right. Well, people have long wondered, well, why do these ants come in two different sizes? And they've had all sorts of ideas. And basically, what they are is they're guards against parasites. And there's a particularly nasty kind of parasite. It's a fly, and it lands on the big ants and lays its eggs on the ants, and the eggs end up developing inside the ant's head. The head will actually kind of fall off, and the maggot will grow inside of it and then fly off after it develops. So it's really quite horrible. it's tricky for these big ants to fend off these flies, because they sort of zoom up on the ant and they come up, sneak up behind them, and lay the eggs very quickly. So thinking is that these small ants are these parasite guards. Because they're riding on top, and they can go and attack the flies really quickly and get them off before they lay their eggs.
Fascinating. Look, Carl, we're running a little bit short, so there are other questions I'd like to ask, but I want to get to your new book. So let me just say a couple of things. The question I was going to ask, there's a tree that senses the actual species of a caterpillar which is attacking it, and it sends out wasp-attracting pheromones for that specific caterpillar. We don't have time for the proper answer, but the tree actually knows what's attacking it, and it summons the wasp that will parasitize that.
Yeah,
fascinating, fascinating. Also, chimps make sandals. I love that, but we can't discuss it because I want to ask you about your new book, which is due out in May, called Microcosm, E. coli and the New Science of Life. Can you give us about 2 minutes on that book?
Sure. People, when the people hear about E. coli, they just think about something that's going to make them sick if they eat the wrong hamburger. The fact is that E. coli is actually at the center of biology. The reason that we know what genes are made of and how genes work is thanks to E. coli. We all carry E. coli in us, like billions of copies, and it's completely harmless to us. There are just these certain disease-causing strains. So what I decided to do was to ask a big question. The question is, what is life? And try to answer it with a very small organism, E. coli. And the fact is that because scientists understand E. coli so well, you can actually answer that question pretty well with just by looking at how E. coli works, how all it's got about 4,000 genes, how they all work together to keep something alive, how they exist in the ecosystem that is the inside of our bodies. Scientists are also using...
What time is the exact feed?
And scientists are also using E. coli for genetic engineering. It was the first organism that got a gene from another species, thanks to humans. And so when we talk about sort of the new frontier of creating life from scratch or engineering human cells, it's E. coli that can give us some of the most important guidance about where we're going.
Okay, again, the book is Microcosm, E. coli and the New Science of Life. What is your website, Carl? I think people would love to log on.
It's CarlZimmer.com.
CarlZimmer.com. I took a look at it, and it's so much there. You could peruse it for hours. Also, you have an award-winning blog, I understand. We have about a minute, Carl. I'd like to ask you, have we gone too far in our environmental destruction, or is there hope for the organism, for our species? And you got about a minute to answer that huge question.
Well, you know, there are a lot of trends that are really, really should be of some concern. You know, we are altering the atmosphere at a rate that has not been seen very often in the history of the planet, and that's going to have real effects on us as well as on the rest of life.
Can we survive?
I suspect we can because we're very smart, but I'm not. I wouldn't be able to guarantee it because we depend on the ecosystems around us,
right.
And we depend on them in ways we don't even appreciate. We depend on it for cleaning our water. We depend on it for fish that we eat. We depend on ecosystems in all sorts of ways. And those ecosystems are under a lot of stress these days.
Okay, Carl, I'm going to have to end it there. It's fascinating. The book is fabulous. The new book is called Microcosm, E. coli, and the New Science of Life. Thanks so much for being with us, Carl.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. I'd like to thank Seth Bengelsdorf and Carl Zimmer for joining us on Environmentally Sound today. I like the mix we sometimes get, the details of our real lives, as with the computers all of us use, whether we know it or not. You don't think of your TV, your microwave, or your watch, or your cell phone, or your automobile to be computers, but they really are. Contrast that with the grand questions about life and evolution, the organism which share our lives, both externally and as passengers within us. Our thought for the week, the biggest risk you can take is take no risks at all. Stay tuned to WVOX, your quintessential community radio station, the flagship of Whitney Radio. Next up, Howard Sturman, gentleman and thinker. Thank you very much for listening. Remember to be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. You are here. It is now. Health and happiness to you all.
This is the flagship station of Whitney Media, live from New York's Golden Apple, 1460 WVOX New Rochelle, and worldwide at WVOX.com.